Is there a biblical basis to yoga? We'll find out on our third installment of Eastern Religions. I'm Rabbi Yossi Madvig, and you're listening to Jews Did It First. All right, I'm back and better than ever, and I've done a couple of episodes on Eastern religions and the starting of it, just to kind of recap very briefly. I spoke about how there is a tradition in Judaism that Abraham, when he sent his descendants, as described, I believe in Genesis 25, he sends his descendants out into the East, and these are sons of his second wife, whose name was Keturah. But according to Jewish tradition, that was Hagar, the handmaid of Abraham, who gave birth to Ishmael, or Ishmael, the founder of the Arab nations. And he had other children with her. He remarried her later on. And these children were sent to the East, it says, and he gave them gifts. And Jewish tradition tells us that he gave them special names of God and ways of communing with spirituality, but from a not as holy origin, from what's called klipa, sort of the husk that surrounds godliness. So it wasn't this direct godly connection, but it was a spiritual connection through the veil of creation. And so we've gone through over the last couple of Eastern religion episodes the similarities that I believe can be traced back to the teachings of Abraham and his descendants that they shared with those in the East, such as in India and China and the like. So today, I want to do the last installment of this, and I think it'll be last installment. I think three episodes on Eastern religion should be enough in a Jewish context, and I want to focus specifically on one thing, and that is the Yoga Sutra. So I don't want to talk about so much the, you know, the positions and all that kind of stuff that you get into with yoga. That's not really the point. More the philosophy behind yoga, where it's coming from, all the different aspects or components of yoga as a philosophy. And I will show you how basically they are all found in the Jewish Bible. Now, the Yoga Sutra that I'll be using, it's called the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, and basically the Yoga Sutra was written somewhere between the years 500 and 200 BCE. And this is about 1,000 years after the Torah was written. However, some of the things I'll be discussing are not necessarily Torah quotes. Some of them are from the later writings, like Psalms, and as well as the prophets. And so even though those are written later than the Torah, they are still written prior to the Yoga Sutra. So I still think that they are relevant, and even though, like I said in the past, that Abraham lived before the Torah was given, we have this tradition that the Torah was handed down person to person, the teachings of the Torah, the history of the Torah, and that was given through Abraham, through really going back all the way through Noah, through his son Shem, and then to his grandson Aver, and going all the way through the line to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and so on. And actually, this is relevant as well to certain artifacts that were handed down that you can hear about if you go back and listen to the Excalibur episode, which I believe was episode, I don't know, 2 or 3 or something like that. It was in the single digits. So I would suggest going back to listen to that and show the progression of how certain artifacts were handed down as well through the generations. Now, the Yoga Sutras have, the translation I'm using, by the way, that I'll be using for anything that I quote, is translated by a guy named Chip Hartranft. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. This was in 2003. It's a PDF online, and the reason I liked it was because it wasn't so much commentary. He basically showed kind of word for word how he was translating, and then wrote out a sentence that kind of made sense in English based on each word that he does. So I like that he wasn't so much pontificating, as just showing this is what it says, this is what it means. So I really appreciated that, and I don't like it when people translate things in a way that just gives you their conclusions of what it means and not what the text actually says. So the Yoga Sutra mentions 8 limbs or components of yoga, and like I said, all these are found in the Bible. And those 8 components are external discipline, internal discipline, posture, breath regulation, concentration, meditative absorption, and oneness or integration. So the first two, the external discipline and the internal discipline, have several parts. So we'll take some time and go through those. The external discipline, which are called yamas, they are not harming, truthfulness, not stealing, celibacy, and not being possessive. Now, the first one, right, this is right in the Ten Commandments. Some of these are really right in the Ten Commandments. The first one right there, you shall not murder, right? Not harming, don't murder. And beyond that, Adam and Eve are actually commanded in the Garden of Eden not to harm even the animals and not even for food, right? So this is a biblical attribute. Even after the flood, when God does permit man to eat animals, there are certain restrictions about causing harm to humans that are expressly forbidden. And even when it comes to eating an animal, we have in Jewish tradition, it's called Eiver Min HaChai. A person is not allowed to eat the limb of a live animal, meaning basically when you kill it, it has to be completely dead first. You know, don't start ripping it apart or cutting it up while it's still alive. And this is because it is cruel and it is harmful to the animal, even though they're dying, right? So you'd think, oh, if it's dying anyway, then who really cares? No. You have to have a certain mode of conduct, a certain responsibility towards not harming that animal, even if it's in the throes of death. So this is a very Jewish concept of not causing harm, certainly needless harm, to others. Obviously, when talking about self-defense or something like that, there's a different story. But even then, you can't be cruel. Truthfulness, the second of the external disciplines, that's right there in the Ten Commandments, right there again. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Now, there's also a biblical injunction, aside from the Ten Commandments, to keep away from falsehood. Midvar sheker tirchak, you should keep away from falsehood. And that is in Exodus 23. That injunction is also found in Proverbs. And of course, you have the famous don't lie. Right? That's pretty much straightforward. In the Ten Commandments, it doesn't say don't lie. It says don't bear false witness, which is an issue of oaths and courts and so on and so forth. But if you look in Leviticus in chapter 19, it just says flat out, do not lie. Now, the stealing, another one mentioned in the Ten Commandments itself, right? Do not steal. Now, in addition, the Bible actually tells us in many places not to steal, whether property, as it's talking about in Leviticus 19, or anything else whatsoever. And that is a little bit nebulous. So I just want to parse that out a little bit for you. Stealing in Judaism doesn't just mean taking someone's stuff. It can also refer to taking another human being, which actually, according to Jewish tradition, the Ten Commandments, when it says not to steal in the Ten Commandments, is actually talking about kidnapping specifically. And I'm not going to get into how they learned that out. But stealing can also be interpreted in other ways to mean stealing a person's mind, meaning through misleading them or cheating them. And the truth is, even as a joke or a prank, this is seen as something that is not acceptable according to Jewish law. Which, you know, I will say I'm definitely, well, no, I'm not guilty of it. I play pranks on people, but I don't lie to them when I do it usually. I just play the prank and it's great. So anyway, all right, so that's the there's also celibacy. Celibacy is an interesting thing. Contrary to popular belief, it's actually highly praised in Judaism. Not complete celibacy like Catholic priests, but a version of it. So Judaism, like many other religions, absolutely prohibits intimacy before marriage. Even after marriage, relations are to be had in a state of ritual purity and primarily for the purpose of procreation. It doesn't mean that that has to be the only thing, but it just means you shouldn't be, as it says in the Talmud, a husband should not come to his wife like a chicken in the hen house or something like this. You know, we're not animals, we're human beings, and we have to conduct ourselves as such. Now, the yama of celibacy in Hinduism is also quite demanding. Certainly, someone who is unmarried has to abstain from any sexual contact, just like in Judaism. Likewise, married couples practicing this discipline are to abstain from having relations except for once a month, and some forms will basically just say it just means to be monogamous. So there's different understandings, different interpretations of how to apply this discipline of celibacy. But from what I can find in the little bit of research that I did, I'm certainly not a Hindu scholar, so please don't take my word solely for this. I encourage you to, you know, if you know more about this, please contact me. I'm happy to learn more. And also do your own research, find out if you're curious. But it seems like that nowadays, especially, it doesn't seem to promote celibacy at, again, like in the Catholic priest sense, where there's this wholesale celibate culture, but it seems to just be in the sense of no premarital sex and abstaining from relations sometimes, or at least being completely and solely monogamous when you are in a married relationship. And that's actually, this is very much in line with the laws of Nida in Judaism. The Torah actually prohibits relations while the woman is menstruating. And upon completion, she has to go through a whole ritual cleansing of herself, not just a ritual, she has a physical cleansing of herself, and she immerses herself in a mikveh, which is a ritual bath. And I spoke about this in the episode that we just did recently on confirmation and baptism, so you can learn more about that there. And only then is she permitted to her husband. So this is actually the time when she's most fertile, interestingly enough, and it happens every month. So while Judaism doesn't confine relations to once a month, like some forms of Hinduism do in understanding this yama of celibacy, but it certainly is considered virtuous to refrain from frivolous intimacy, like I said earlier, even in the, I was going to say even in the context of marriage, but in Judaism, every act of intimacy should only be in the context of marriage. So there you go. And then finally, for the external disciplines, you have rejecting possessiveness or greed or something like that. And this is, again, also mentioned right in the Ten Commandments. In fact, it's the last one, right? You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his servants or his maidservants or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So that's right there. Don't be greedy. Don't be possessive. Don't desire that which others have. And there are also injunctions to tithe. Abraham himself gave a portion of his possessions to the king of Salem, which is, according to tradition, is Jerusalem. And the king's name was Melchizedek, who, by the way, according to Jewish tradition, was Shem, the son of Noah. And he has this battle. Abraham has this battle with the four kings. And not only that, not only did he give 10% of his things, of his possessions, to this king, but he also he didn't take any spoils that were offered to him from the king of Sodom, who he saved when he was fighting this battle. And he said, neither, Abraham says, and this is from, this quote is from Genesis 14. He says, neither from a thread to a shoe strap, nor will I take from you whatever is yours, that you should not say, I have made Avram wealthy. So he just, you know, whatever I get is from God. I don't want you to think that you did anything to make me wealthy. And I'm sure he doesn't want himself to think that he made himself wealthy. So everything comes from God. It's not about what I have or what I can get. It's just whatever God gives me. Other places in the Torah and Jewish law do extol the virtue of eschewing worldly possessions. But I'm bringing up Abraham specifically to emphasize the idea that these concepts came from Abraham, who, like I said, had his descendants travel east and proclaim these virtues and these values that they learned in Abraham's home. So that's for the external disciplines, right? Things that the way in which you relate to the outside world. Then you have the five internal disciplines, or the niyamas. So the external card yamas, and then you have the internal ones, which are called niyamas. Now, I'm not really giving the terms for the disciplines, all these different disciplines, in the Sanskrit or whatever, because, listen, I don't really know Sanskrit, and I'm probably going to totally butcher the pronunciation, so, you know, I apologize if I'm not giving you the names and you don't like that. Sorry, you can look up the names for yourself. There's lots of resources online as to where you can find out what they're called. Anyway, so these niyamas, the internal disciplines, are how you are relating to yourself. So those are, there's five of those, and they are bodily purification, contentment, intensity or like persistence or perseverance, self-study, and orientation toward the ideal of pure awareness. Okay, so these are, again, these are the sort of translations of what they are. And this is coming from the Yoga Sutra, section 2, line 32. So if you really want to look it up, you can look it up over there and find, you know, if you know any Sanskrit and you can translate yourself, then go right ahead and do that because that's great. So bodily purification is something that Judaism takes very seriously. Hindus will typically cleanse in a river, preferably the Ganges, in order to achieve ritual purity. Now, in Judaism, one can either use a natural body of water, like a river or something like that, or they could use a ritual bath or a mikveh, which is man-made. And the Book of Leviticus is replete with injunctions on how to use a mikveh and how to make it and so on, and to cleanse yourself of various ritual impurities, such as a blood flow or contact with a dead body or tzara'as, which is this skin condition that they would get in biblical times, and a host of other reasons, including a non-Jew converting to Judaism. And again, I discuss more about mikveh episode dealing with baptism. Now, the next inner discipline, which is contentment or joy. Now, we all know that Judaism loves to argue. We love the back and forth. And of course, we complain. We're a stiff-necked people. I mean, the Talmud is really just a whole string of arguments that go on for hundreds of years, actually. But the reality is that Judaism places a lot of emphasis on contentment and joy. Anger is something to be minimized for sure, if not altogether obliterated. The 12th century authority Maimonides, or the Rambam, he writes that one who becomes angry is as though that person has worshipped idols. So that's the 12th century. Now going back to the 2nd century, I believe, or the 3rd century CE, you have Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, and he says in the Talmud that any person who becomes angry, if he is a Torah scholar, his wisdom departs from him, and if he is a prophet, his prophecy departs from him. And now we go all the way back to the Torah itself, which, like I said, was written in the 13th century BCE, and it's talking about Jacob. So this is happening, you know, even I think about 400 years before that event, the event of giving of the Torah. So the Torah itself, it describes Jacob chastising his sons, Shimon and Levi, for the anger that they displayed against the people of Shechem. So if you're unfamiliar with this story, I'll just give a very quick recap. Basically, the king of Shechem, or his son really, takes Dinah, who's Jacob's daughter, and he abducts her, and he forcibly marries her. You know, it's a family program, right? And so Shimon and Levi, who are two of her brothers, are obviously quite upset about this, and they say, okay, sure, you can, you know, marry our daughters and so on and so forth, but that's only if everyone becomes circumcised. So if you all circumcise yourself, and then we'll allow it. So they say, great, sure, we'll do it. And they make a proclamation in the entire area that's like a city. He's a king, but back then, I guess it was more like little tiny provinces, right? So everyone in the province, they circumcise themselves. And while they're all kind of reeling in pain, while all the men are reeling in pain from this circumcision, Shimon and Levi go in, and the two of them just completely obliterate everyone. They kill everyone, and it's a big mess, and they get Dinah back. So Jacob was very upset about this. It was it was a bad thing that they did, and he chastised them for it. So that is just avoiding anger, right? But what about contentment itself, right? The actual joy. You can turn away from, you know, not being angry, but what about actually being happy, being content? So the first century sage, Ben Zoma, he says, who is wealthy? One who is content with his portion. Who is rich? Someone who is happy with his portion. But that's the first century. So that's already after the Yoga Sutras have been written. Well, King David in Psalm 100 tells us, Ivdu es Hashem basimcha, serve God with joy. And his son, King Solomon, tells us that a content heart makes a cheerful countenance. He that is of a good heart has a continual feast. So that's going into the writings. So this is a few hundred years before the sutras. And even the Torah itself enjoins us to serve Hashem with love and joy and contentment. And you can see this in Deuteronomy chapter 6, as well as in Deuteronomy chapter 28. And these are just a few examples. Judaism is about, you know, you have to be happy, you have to serve God with joy. You can't be, a big stick in the mud, as they say. So moving on to the next one, this intensity or persistence. Now, this is probably the quintessential Jewish trait. I mean, a brief look at Jewish history shows that our mere existence is a testament to that. But where did it come from? So going all the way back to our patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it's clear that this attribute has very deep roots. So to start with Abraham, he was tested 10 times, according to the Mishnah. And according to some commentaries, some are actually only mentioned in the Midrash, but many say that all of them are mentioned in the Torah. So what are those 10 times? Well, the ones that are mentioned just in the Midrash, those are, he was hiding in a cave for the first 13 years of his life. He spent 10 years in prison and being thrown into a fire for his belief in God. So these are some that are just mentioned in the Midrash that some count as the 10 tests of Abraham. But others, like the Rambam, who we mentioned earlier, he actually gives a pure biblical listing. So according to him, the list reads like this, his 10 trials where he really persevered and had this persistence and intensity of loving and serving God. Number one is God tells him to leave his homeland to be a stranger in the land of Canaan. That's a big deal. And he does it. He's 75 years old, picks up everything from everything he's ever known, and he goes wandering to serve God. Number two, immediately after his arrival in the promised land, he encounters a famine. Number three, the Egyptians seize his wife Sarah and bring her to Pharaoh. Four, Abraham faces incredible odds in the battle of the four and five kings that we spoke about earlier. Five, he marries Hagar after not being able to have children with Sarah. He wants to have children. He's had this wife. He and his wife can't have any children for a decade. God tells him to circumcise himself when he's 90 years old. Or sorry, 99 years old, right? God tells him to send Hagar away after having a child with her, right? They couldn't have children. So he gets this Hagar lady. They finally have a child. And then God tells her to send them away. His son Ishmael becomes estranged from him. They really don't have too much contact. And then finally God tells him to sacrifice Isaac on the altar. So this is, these are tremendous, tremendous tests that Abraham had to go through. And this is the founding of our nation. Isaac himself also had to persevere and keep the faith, as it were. He was persecuted by the Philistines. He was bound as a human sacrifice, right? The last trial of Abraham was a trial of Isaac as well. And he was separated from his son Jacob for 36 years, right? Jacob had to run away because he stole the birthright from Esav, and Esav wanted to kill him, and so he ran away to Laban, and he was a shepherd there for many years, and then he finally came back. Jacob himself, he had a lot to deal with. He had to run away from home, like I just said, for fear of his brother murdering him. He had to work day and night for his father-in-law, Laban, for 14 years. He had his life threatened by Laban, and his daughter and son were taken from him. Remember, I mentioned Dinah, who was captured by Shechem, and then his son Joseph was sold into slavery to Egypt, and he thought he was dead. So there is a Jewish idiom that says, Maisa avos simin labanim. Everything that occurred to our patriarchs are an omen or a portent for the children of Israel. This is the inheritance that the Jewish people have. And through it all, we stand tall, we face the world, and offer hope and love in Hashem, in God. Now, the other self-niyama, the inner discipline, is studying the self, right? Hinduism teaches that by studying yourself, you come closer to the divine. And Judaism believes very much in self-study to ensure you're always on the right path that God has set forth. Three times a day, we pray to God, we recount our transgressions. It's not enough to ask for forgiveness, but to actually confess the sins. And this allows us to reflect on our behavior and our speech and our thoughts in order to rectify them and do better in the future. Now, while this is codified into Jewish law in around the 12th century, certainly by the Rambam, it was actually the actual practice was instituted by the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, which are the men of the Great Assembly, and that's around the 5th century BCE, just before Hinduism officially hits the world stage and kind of just right before these sutras are being written, maybe about a century before these yoga sutras are being written. And before that, in the Bible itself, the idea of reflecting on past deeds and rectifying your future behavior is all over the Bible. It's all over the Tanakh, from the five books of Moses all the way through the prophets. I mean, it could be said that the main objective of the prophets is to get the Jewish people to reflect on their past actions and make them better. And finally, the most, I guess, metaphysical of these inner disciplines is the idea of this awareness or consciousness. So the Hindu, I will give the Hindu one for this. It's called Isvara. And it's, again, like this awareness or something like this. And the sutra says like this. It says, this is from section 2, line 45. And it says, through orientation toward the ideal of pure awareness, one can achieve integration. So this idea is certainly found in later mystical traditions of Judaism. Hasidic philosophy, especially Chabad Hasidus, explains that this is the Kabbalistic characteristic of das, or knowledge. Right? You have three intellectual attributes. There's wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Chochma, Bina, and Das. And wisdom is this flash of intellect that, from that flash, you expound upon it to fully grasp its implications. That's more the understanding aspect. So you have the wisdom, which is the flash, and then you have the expansion of that to grasp what it means. That's the understanding. And then you have the knowledge. But knowledge is really to be fully aware of the idea and integrate it into your life. So a person who possesses Das will exhibit rational, mature behavior, whereas someone who doesn't have Das is emotionally immature and will become plagued by this inner emotional conflict. And this is basically a sort of a brief rundown of a little bit of Chabad Hasidic thought. Now, having this awareness can be found not just in later Kabbalistic things, but also if you can go to the second century. Now, this is after the Yoga Sutras, but I'm just kind of working backwards, where it says, everything you do should be for the sake of heaven. Okay, this is in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, chapter 2, Mishnah 12, right? Everything you do should be l'shem shemaim, everything should be for the sake of heaven. But there's even a similar thought earlier than that, which is half a millennium before the sutra, where King Solomon enjoins us to know Hashem in all of your ways. Know him, behold darchecho deyehu, know him in all your ways. That is found in Proverbs chapter 3. And even a half a millennium before that, Moses himself instructs us, know today, v'yodaita hayoyim, this lesson of das, know today and place it on your heart that the Lord is God in heavens above and the earth below, there is no other. So Judaism taught its adherents 1,000 years before the sutra the importance of integrating divine awareness into our lives. So I think what I'll do is, it's running late, so what I think I'll do is I'm going to hold there. I guess I really wanted this to be the last Eastern religion, but perhaps what I'll do, I'll do another one commenting on these. I think I already did an episode on reincarnation, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe I should double check that. I think in my first Eastern religion episode, I covered some things like meditation and stuff like that. But I'm going to go back. I'm going to give that a listen. And anything that I didn't cover there, I'll make into a fourth episode. Because, like I said, there are disciplines here that these components of the Yoga Sutra, like posture and breath regulation and concentration and so on, and this oneness or integration that I really didn't touch upon here. And I would like to do that. But I think that right now it's already been, it's already been about a half an hour. And, you know, I think we should hold it there. And I think that we've had a good amount of Torah learning going on of different ideas and concepts that are brought in Torah and ways to integrate them in your life. And so I'm not going to have a specific Devar Torah today. So I will leave you with that, with the fact that these concepts that we tend to think of as Eastern and mystical and you know, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, this Eastern mysticism are really found right in our own backyard. So if you're Jewish and you've been contemplating these Eastern religions because you feel, you know, that there's so much more truth or beauty or depth in these concepts in, say, Hinduism or Buddhism, I really encourage you, find your local synagogue, preferably a Chabad house, and look up the rabbi and say, hey, you know, I would love, these are the ideas that I am interested in, and I want to know how to incorporate them in a Jewish life. Because believe me, you don't need to go searching for these other things. I'm not saying, you know, if you're not Jewish, I'm not saying there's not a lot of truth and beauty to be found in these other religions. But if you are Jewish, I will leave you with this. How about there's a story instead of a Devar Torah, I'll tell you a story. Story time with Rabbi Yossi, right? The story is like this, that there was once a man and he was a woodcutter and he was very poor and he had a dream. And in his dream, Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, comes to him and tells him to go to such and such a town under a bridge, and there he'll find a treasure in the ground. So the guy's, okay, whatever. It's kind of a silly dream. It's just a dream. I'm not going to pay attention. Well, the next night, he has the same exact dream. He says, okay, you know, I've kind of been thinking about it, whatever. It's just a dream. After the third night, he had the same exact dream. He says, you know what? Tells his wife, honey, I'm packing my bags. I'm going to this town to go look for the treasure. He goes to the town and he finds the bridge and he starts digging. After a little while, someone comes up to him and says, hey, buddy, what are you doing? He says, nothing. I mean, what do you want? He says, no, it's straight. You're digging. What's going on? Tell me. I'm not going to bother you. I'm curious. So he says, you know, tell you the truth, it's going to sound crazy, but I had a dream and I had it three times and it told me to come here and dig and I would find a treasure. So I'm here digging. What can I say? I know it sounds silly, but that's what it is. So the man laughs. He says, you're right. He says, you're right. That is silly. I mean, I had a dream that told me to go to, Yopitz, whatever, some town, and I should look in the house of a woodcutter and find a treasure under his oven. You know, but that's ridiculous. Why would I? It's still a stupid dream. Why would I go do that? He just keeps laughing, walks away. He says, good luck, buddy. So this guy, we'll call him Yankel, this woodcutter, he says, hey, wait a minute. I live in that town, and I'm a woodcutter. Huh. So he goes back home, puts down the shovel, goes back home, tears his oven up from the floor, opens the floorboards there, and lo and behold, a treasure right in his own backyard, so to speak. So likewise, many Jewish people feel that we have to go searching in this place and that place to find all these lofty ideals, when really, if we just do a little more digging in our very own house within Jewish tradition, which is thousands of years old, we'll find more than we could have possibly bargained for. So with that, I wish you a great day, Shabbat Shalom, and until next time.